headlines, Iran and IEA agree on a roadmap to resolve all outstanding issues by late June 2021. Iran's security chief says Israel is the greatest enemy of the Muslim world, in reaction to the Saudi crown prince calling Israel a potential ally. Plus, Russian President Vladimir Putin says any country that imposes a no-fly zone over Ukraine will be considered as a party to the conflict with Russia. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization says that Tehran and the International Atomic Energy Agency have agreed on a roadmap to resolve all outstanding issues.
In the agreement we made with the IAEA and the negotiations that took place within the past days and weeks between us and Mr. Grossi, today we announced this agreement with a statement. There are steps we're taking to cooperate with each other in the form of mutual assistance. We decided to exchange the necessary documents between Iran and the IAEA by June 21st.
The Islami was speaking at a press conference with the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, in Tehran. He said the IAEA's decisions should not be affected by lobbying or political influences and intervention. He expressed hope that cooperation between Iran and the agency will follow a professional and non-political procedure. The Islami also noted that full withdrawal of anti-Iran allegations are the country's red lines in the Vienna talks, which he said are in their final stage. Then Rafael Grossi stressed that the safeguards issues with Iran should be resolved in order for the 2015 deal to be revived. The IAEA chief described his talks with the Islami as intense but fruitful. Grossi has also met with the Iranian foreign minister. His Tehran visit comes as Iran and the remaining parties to the 2015 deal are in Vienna negotiating the revival of the accord. Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, calls Israel the biggest enemy of the Muslim world. Shamkhani made the comment in a tweet after the Saudi crown prince talked about the kingdom's relationship with the Israeli regime. Mohammed bin Salman said that Riyadh is looking for ways to coexist with Iran but does not look at Israel as an enemy. He also said that Tel Aviv will probably be an ally of Riyadh in the future. The top Iranian security official also referred to bilateral talks between Tehran and Riyadh. He said the talks hosted by Iraq stem from Iran's principled strategy of cooperating with its neighbors based on bilateral and regional interests. Those talks are aimed at diffusing tensions over a host of issues, including the Yemen war. Academic and geopolitical analyst, policy analyst, Alexander Assadgan says the Saudi crown prince's desire for ties with Israel is part of his game plan to survive amid internal strife in the kingdom.
I think Mohammed bin Salman is coming to his senses in some way. He came to power in bloodshed as a deputy crown prince in 2015. And now he's got internal strife. Not too long ago, there was a possible palace coup by his brother, Bandar Salman. He feels cornered. He feels threatened. He has powerful enemies in Saudi Arabia. And that's why the Saudis in general are softening up. I don't think Iran should be so welcoming of them. And on the same token, obviously, Saudi Arabia and Israel could have their own diplomatic relationship. But when there's such enmity between Iran and Israel, and Israel is clearly taking advantage of the present situation where the global audience is completely focused on Russia and Ukraine, Israel is committing the most barbaric acts. We all see the videos of it, the clips of it, but they are pretty much getting away with it because I would even argue that President Biden is even more of a Zionist than his ridiculous predecessor.
Israel and the United Arab Emirates boost their ties further, with Abu Dhabi allowing Tel Aviv to resume a full schedule of flights to the Sheikhdom. Israel's internal spy agency, Shin Bet, says the two sides have settled a dispute over airport security that forced them to cut back air services. Israel's flag carrier, Al Al, has welcomed the announcement, saying that it will immediately return to operating up to four flights a day. Non-stop flights from Tel Aviv to Dubai were among the issues agreed upon as part of a U.S.-backed normalization deal between Israel and the UAE. That deal was clinched in 2020, drawing strong backlash from Muslims and Palestinians who see the accord as a betrayal of their cause. Reactions are pouring in following a deadly suicide bombing that devastated a Shia mosque in the northwestern Pakistani city of Peshawar on Friday. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned the bombing. He said places of worship should be safe havens, not targets of attacks. Iraq's top Shia cleric, Ayatollah Ali Sistani, denounced the tragic incident also. He called on Islamabad to tackle terrorist groups and not to allow them to commit crimes against innocent people, especially religious minorities. Iran said the attack was aimed at sowing discord among Muslims. The European Union slammed the bombing as a heinous crime. The blast targeted worshippers during Friday prayers, killing nearly 60 people and injuring dozens more. The Daesh terrorist group claimed responsibility. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Moscow's offensive in Ukraine is in its 10th day, with Russian forces inching closer to the capital, Kiev. Russian troops have encountered stiff resistance along the way, including in Kiev's western suburbs and the northern town of Chernihiv. Russia has announced a ceasefire in the besieged port city of Mariupol, as well as the nearby town of Volnovakha, to allow civilians to evacuate. However, Russia's defense ministry says no one has used the two humanitarian corridors and has accused Ukrainian nationalists of preventing civilians from leaving. Ukrainian officials have accused Moscow of violating the truce and shelling Mariupol. Meanwhile, the Russian President Vladimir Putin has warned against imposing a no-fly zone on Ukraine.
Any country that seeks to impose a no-fly zone will be considered by us to have entered the conflict. Imposing a no-fly zone will have colossal and catastrophic consequences not only for Europe but also the whole world.
Putin says that Western sanctions are akin to a declaration of war. He reiterated that his country aims to defend the Russian-speaking communities in Ukraine through demilitarizing and denazifying the country. The fighting began on February 24. The UN Refugee Agency has reported the departure of 1.3 million refugees from Ukraine so far. Christopher Horstel is a writer, politician, and analyst who joins us from Berlin. We also have James Tweedy, who's a journalist and writer who joins us from Plymouth. Welcome to you both. Let me start with you, Christopher Horstel, if I may. We're looking at the 10th day of operations that Russia has exerted on Ukraine. The one side we don't hear much about, of which we hear from Russia, is the denazifying the extreme nationals and also regarding the demilitarization. Tell us the side that Russia is narrating, because it's not the narration or the line that Western media is reporting.
Yeah, we have an information war right now in highest gear, really top gear. We have all kinds of, you know, secret service activities, for example, in the recently Russian-occupied city of Kherson, where the population reportedly by New York Times and things like that takes to the street to protest against the Russian side, and that doesn't seem credible. The group is small, but the camera movements are vivid. So we see this kind of thing. We see also that the strategy and tactics of Russia were in fact anticipating a smoother transition. Nobody in the West is giving Ukraine the faintest chance to truly withstand the Russian army. That is very natural. We don't need to discuss that. But the fact is that the Ukrainian government wants to, you know, drown the country in weapons coming from the West. They are largely, you know, then taken over by the Russian army as they approach. But this means this president of Ukraine is ready to ruin his country in order to, you know, make a deal with Washington that he is their leader in Ukraine. That is crazy. He has another 2 months, I think, then he's gone. And now the Russian side will have to change the way. They need to put more people inside. They have used tank columns and truck columns. That is not enough. They need more people on the ground to really rule the situation. And this leads to this announcement by President Putin just a few hours ago that Ukraine may lose its statehood if it continues to wage a fierce war in fact, against Russian people. Russian people fighting Russian people is a wonderful story for Washington. They love to, you know, push Muslims against Muslims, and now they're putting Slavish people against Slavs, and that is a hobby, obviously not, you know, racist or religious. It's just that they are criminals in Washington.
Well, that's a very dangerous concoction here that Washington is stirring, if that is indeed the case, James Tweedy. And we're looking also at reports, aside from the fact of what our guest said about the West, even Germany has ramped up its arms to Ukraine and a host of other countries, of course the U.S. also, but also reports of how these mercenaries are now being brought into Ukraine, many coming from what we understand, Syria, U.S.-backed, supported, or otherwise. Why is the West so keen on having this environment, this militarization of this conflict, knowing what it's going to lead to, which at this point we're seeing, you know, civilian deaths slowly but surely ratchet up? So this is for James Tweedy. I'm sorry.
Well,
go ahead, James Tweedy.
Yes, thanks for inviting me today. The West doesn't really care about the Ukrainian people in this. I mean, it's the European Union and NATO want to expand. They want to keep expanding. Like classic imperialism, you must expand or else you stagnate and you die. So they will always seek new territories. And you see how the European Union economically treats many of the later members from Eastern Europe and some, and many of the older members from Southern Europe as colonies. Just to provide cheap labour for the richest countries of the EU, like Germany and France. And that's already happening, by the way, with Ukraine. I mean, we talk about a migrant crisis and, you know, a refugee crisis now because of the war. But actually, I mean, many people say that millions of people have already emigrated from Ukraine. Some have gone to the West, to the European Union, and those who speak Russian have gone to Russia. The shelling by the Ukrainian army before the Russian army intervened created another 700,000 refugees from the Donbass region going to Russia. The US and NATO more generally is ready to push the world to the brink of nuclear war just to gain some kind of advantage over Russia, for instance, putting their missiles, nuclear missiles, possibly, you know, ballistic missiles, within a few hundred miles of Moscow, where they could actually, you know, destroy Moscow before the alarm could be raised. Of course, Russia is not going to allow that. And people talk about Ukraine's right, sovereign right, as a country, to decide whether it joins the NATO alliance or not, or the European Union, but, you know, that those sovereign rights have to be weighed against the collective security of the whole world as it is now, or at least the Northern Hemisphere, the life of everybody living in the Northern Hemisphere.
Christopher Horsell, this is what the U.S. has wanted to do. One way or another, obviously Russia has been on its radar. China and Russia, number one and two, I believe, in terms of what the U.S. considers as national security threats. And, of course, we're seeing the economic war that's being waged on Russia at the same time. Do you think that there were those kinds of incentives behind U.S. and NATO, maybe, as to what we're seeing?
From the start and since the downfall of the Soviet Union, openly, there are think tank publications in the U.S. And the nice things about our American friends is they are so open, so you can read it all. They wanted to bring Russia down same way as they did with the Soviet Union. If you look at the career of President Zelensky, he was sponsored by a Ukrainian oligarch with an Israeli passport who put him into his TV set, let him act in 23 series of a TV series and 23 sequels, and playing a little teacher who has become by chance president of the Ukraine. And that guy is an actor. He is a real complete puppet. He's a make-up story by some deep state interests. And these interests go very clearly. This is why they arm the Ukraine, even if they have no chance of withstanding. They arm it. They want to rather destroy Ukraine than let the Russian army do their job there for the Russian security. In fact, we know the run-up of atrocities by the Ukrainian armed forces on the Donbass Republic, terrible 14,000 deaths in 8 years. And then there's this Alley of Angels, the street where all the children are buried, who lost right. their lives due to okay. Ukrainian stories. So bring Russia down is the main incentive.
James Tweedy, in less than a minute, the U.S. is very happy, along with NATO countries, to pump up Ukraine with arms. But yet it doesn't want to participate in a no-fly zone. It doesn't want to get into a war with Russia. What do you think that means, and what does that in turn spell for Ukrainians, of which the President Zelensky has showed his feelings towards it?
Well, like my fellow guest said, Zelensky is acting like Adolf Hitler did in the last days of last month of the Second World War, when pressed arms into the hands of old men and boys and sent them to be slaughtered against the approaching Allied armies. The U.S. it pushed Ukraine into a war with Russia, which Ukraine provoked, but it's not backing them up because, as they say, they don't want to create a no-fly zone. A no-fly zone is not a defensive thing, by the way, as we saw in Libya, it's an offensive thing. And they don't want their planes to be shot down. It's one of the things that you must take from that when they say they don't want to shoot down Russian planes. But they know it would lead to nuclear Armageddon, and they don't want to risk that. They will go very far with the rhetoric, though, and the situation is extremely dangerous.
Okay, thank you so much for your contribution, James Tweedy, journalist and writer. And Christopher Horstall, pleasure, writer, politician, and an analyst from Berlin. Thank you. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. And that does it for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
in the limelight.
The sudden concern for international law regarding Ukraine is nowhere to be found when it comes to Israeli regime's illegal occupation, an annexation of Palestinian and Syrian land, and its imposition of an apartheid regime on the entire Palestinian people, a crime against humanity, says Ali Abu Nima, journalist, in an article published under the heading Ukraine crisis highlights West hypocrisy over Israeli regime's land theft. Stay tuned for more. Just a day after Moscow recognized the independence of Donetsk and Luhansk from Ukraine, the European Union came out swinging against what it characterized as Russian aggression. The measure will also hit banks that are financing Russian military and other operations in those territories, and aim to thwart the ability of the Russian state and government to access the EU's capital and financial markets and services. These sanctions, likely to be followed by others, supposedly flow from the EU's deep respect for international law, as well as the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine. The US is also laying out sanctions in response to what Washington describes as Russian invasion of the two eastern regions that have been under control of a pro-Russian separatist since 2014. Germany, which is largely dependent on gas supplies from Russia, announced the suspension of plans to build the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. Washington's goal has been to bring Ukraine into the anti-Russia NATO military alliance, something Moscow sees as an existential threat and is strongly opposed by many among Ukraine's large ethnic Russian population. Yet the sudden concern for international law regarding Ukraine is nowhere to be found when it comes to the Zionist regime's illegal occupation and annexation of Palestinian and Syrian land, and its imposition of an apartheid regime on the entire Palestinian people, a crime against humanity. These Israeli regime's crimes could, of course, not be perpetrated without American and European support. When the Trump administration moved the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Al-Quds in 2017, effectively recognizing the Zionist regime's illegal annexation of the city, the EU rejected the move. The EU also rejected the 2019 U.S. recognition of the Zionist regime's illegal annexation of Syria's occupied Golan Heights. Ironically, one of the handful of countries ready to follow the U.S. in recognizing the Zionist regime's illegal annexation of Al-Quds is none other than the U.S. and EU-backed government in Ukraine. Notably, the Biden administration has refused to rescind Trump's recognition of the Zionist regime's blatantly illegal acts, even as Washington blasts Russia for recognizing Donetsk and Luhansk. Indeed, Biden himself maintains an illegal U.S. occupation of parts of Syria. Under Trump, its explicit purpose was to plunder the country's oil. Yet the European Union, which has criticized both the US and Russia for their actions, has not imposed any sanctions on Washington for aiding and abetting the Zionist regime's crimes. That is hardly surprising. For decades, the European Union has acknowledged that the Zionist regime's occupation, theft, and annexation of Palestinian land is illegal. But instead of sanctioning it, Brussels rewards and encourages it. The stark contrast with the immediate American and EU resort to sanctions against Russia is not lost on Palestinians. Wassam Ahmad of the Palestinian human rights group Al-Haq said recently, "For us as Palestinians, we see this discussion and we ask ourselves, where is this discussion when it comes to Palestine?
Ahmad was speaking during a webinar hosted by Finnish lawmaker Veronica Honkaslo, focusing on a bill she has introduced to ban trading goods from occupied territories. Ahmad observed, "The occupation of Palestinian territory has been going on for a much longer period of time." He said that the persistent lack of action in response to the Zionist regime's violation of Palestinian rights and international law undermines the credibility of the rule of law being something that applies across the board. Frustrated with the complicity, hypocrisy, and unaccountability of their leaders, people across the continent are launching a European Citizens' Initiative to force Brussels to close European markets to products and services from settlements in occupied territories, including the Zionist colonies on Palestinian and Syrian lands. A European Citizens' Initiative is a formal process that is meant to allow citizens to influence EU policy. It requires gathering the signatures of at least 1 million people from across the bloc. This one has already passed the first hurdle of being formally registered by the European Commission, the EU's executive body. That came after the Commission had refused to register a similar initiative in 2019, a decision that was overturned last year when organizers went to court. Even though illegal settlements constitute a war crime under international law, the EU allows trade with them, said the European Legal Support Center, one of 100 organizations urging EU citizens to sign on to the initiative. Human Rights Watch, one of the several major human rights groups that over the last year have concluded that the Israeli regime perpetrates the crime against humanity of apartheid, is also backing the initiatives. Settlements unlawfully rob local populations of their land, resources and livelihoods, Bruno Stagno, chief advocacy officer at Human Rights Watch, stated, adding, "No country should be enabling the trade in goods produced as a result of land theft, displacement and discrimination." Frances Black, an Irish senator who sponsored legislation in her country to ban trade in settlement goods, is also urging support for the initiative. Although passed by the Irish Parliament, the government in Dublin is blocking the implementation of Black's Occupied Territories Bill. Meanwhile, the similar bill in Finland is coming up for the first vote. It has secured 35 sponsors out of Finland's 200 members of parliament. If it passes, this would be only the first step towards becoming law. More than 40 Palestinian human rights, political and cultural organizations have written to Finnish MPs. In a letter seen by the Electronic Intifada, they urge lawmakers to support the bill, calling it a crucial opportunity for Finland to lead by example on complying with relevant obligations under international human rights and international humanitarian law. Contrary to persistent Israel lobby complaints that the Zionist regime is being singled out, all these initiatives would ban trade in goods from any occupied territory, including Western Sahara, which is occupied by Morocco. In September, the European Court of Justice annulled an EU trade deal with Morocco because it included Western Sahara without the consent of its people and their internationally recognized representatives, the Polisario Front. During the recent seminar hosted by Finnish MP Honkaslo, Salah Abdul Mohammed, an advocate for Sahrawi self-determination, charged that the EU continues to allow the import of goods plundered from Sahrawi territories such as sardines and tomatoes. that are falsely labeled as products of Morocco. The European Citizen Initiative, that would stop trade with the Zionist regime settlement, faces an enormous uphill battle. Of course, it would not even be necessary if EU governments really respected the norms they now accuse Russia of violating. But time and again, international law proves not to be a yardstick against which all are measured, but a club used by the strong exclusively for their own advantage.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of RIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
We congratulate all the brothers and sisters on the blessed occasions that we were in these last few days, the birth of our beloved Imam al-Hussein and Imam Zainul Abidin, Salamullah alayhima. And also the birth of Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas, the flag bearer of Karbala, the loyal companion of Imam al-Hussein in Karbala. Inshallah, the celebration and the talk that will be dedicated to what I would like to mention briefly tonight is related to the month of Sha'ban and preparations for the month of Ramadan. In the month of Ramadan, one can simply get through the month and just be saved in a sense of hellfire and simply get just make their way just above a level where there would be the fuel for hell, as God says in the Quran. فَاتَّقُوا النَّارَ الَّتِي وَقُودُهَا النَّاسُ وَالْحِجَارَةُ. Be careful of the fire, the fuel of which is people and stones. We can either set our goal to be simply just barely making it there by the end of the month of Ramadan. All the effort is just get rid of the sins that cause us to go to hell. And then once the month of Ramadan is over again, engage and let loose and lower the guards and go on for another year. Then every month of Ramadan, we're just barely trying to. That's one thing that can happen, which is good. And meaning, God forbid we don't even do that. If we wouldn't even do that, then we're not even believers. There's a more serious problem. But we're saying, let's have this conversation that there's more to it than just that. The prophets, they didn't have this baggage. They ascended in these periods of time, in these occasions that God gave them to ascend. We are bogged down, and the best we can do instead of flying is just remove the weights, get ready for flight. And then once we're ready for flight, the month of Ramadan is over. We're like, okay, next year, inshallah. And then we start piling up the baggage again, and we can't fly anymore. We can't ascend. We can't elevate our souls. Let's use the month of Sha'ban, this great month, through the various practices that have been given to us, the Sunan, the Holy Prophet. He, in a sense, maybe, I don't know, I mean, who are we to say this, but from some of the things that we have been told about who the Prophet is, he didn't, on the level that we do, clearly, of course, this part is clear. On the level we do, he didn't need these the fasts that he was involved in, or the prayers that he was involved in. On the level we are at, those prayers did not have those effects. Those fasts didn't have those effects. He didn't need those fasts the way we need them. But one of the aspects is that he engaged in those fasts as a leader to give people more of a motive, more of an incentive to get involved with this. And then we read in Salawat Sha'baniya that hopefully we get to do these days. So it'll be unfortunate if the month of Sha'ban comes to an end and we don't do it even once. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Al-Fulk al-Jariya fi al-Lujaj al-Ghamira. Very beautiful salawat that takes not too long, a couple minutes, a few minutes max. At Zawal time, if you don't get time at Zawal, right at Dhuhr time afterwards. Sometime during the day. One of the things we say is we describe in the dua, we're taught that the holy, to say as part of the dua, that the Holy Prophet used to fast during the days and used to stand in prayer during the nights in this month. And then we ask in the same dua, O Allah, فَأَعِنَّا عَلَى الْإِسْتِنَانِ بِسُنَّتِهِ. O Allah, help us in taking that tradition of the Prophet, that sunnah of the Prophet, and making it our tradition, and us engaging in that. At least a little bit. Those of us who have qadha fasts, we've got to make them up in this month. As if we don't from last year, if there's anything left from last year, and we haven't made them up to this point, and we don't make them up during the month of Sha'ban, this is a sin, unless we have an excuse that lasted throughout that year, which is rare. You know, there are some people, yeah, from that month of Ramadan to this month of Ramadan, they had legitimate reasons why they could not fast for the entire year. But most people, if it wasn't during the month of Ramadan, it was a trip, it was an illness, it was something. Afterwards, there is an opportunity. If I didn't do it now, I've come here now, something comes up now. It's unfortunate. But for most people, again, something won't come up. Let's make up those fasts. That's necessary. But besides that, take advantage of this month and do more fasts. If there's any qadha from previous years that for whatever reason were not done, do them. The timing is important for the fasts. When it's said that it's mustahab to fast, people get confused. There's a difference between fasting and salah. Salah, the structure of the salah between a wajib and a mustahab salah and prayer are different. During a time, you can be involved with a mustahab prayer or salah or a wajib prayer. What determines the istihbab and the wujub is your intention and then the structure of that prayer, how many rak'ah it is and how you perform it and so on and so forth. With fasting, that's not the case. Fasting is always abstaining from the items that are on the list of abstinence in for fasting for the duration of the day, from Fajr to nightfall, to the end of the day. That's fasting. Whenever you fast, that's what it's going to be. When it says it's mustahab, it means this timing is mustahab to fast. Now the fast that you're doing, is it, do you have qadha fast or you don't and you want to fast? Either way, if you do the fast during that time, you have accomplished that istihbab. So it's not like people who have qadha fasts on their hands, if they haven't done them before, now they can't take advantage of this time for the mustahab timing of fast. No, they can. This is an instance where you can hit two birds with one stone. You do your qadha fast and you've taken care of that mustahab timing for the fast. The fasting, the qiyam and the layl, let's prepare ourselves standing up in prayer during the night, at least sometimes on the weekends, whenever we have time. Those of us who don't have those tight schedules anymore because of the pandemic, take advantage of this. The pandemic will be removed and we will be relieved from the hardships, but we will also be taken, or this blessing of having all that time is going to be taken away from us. And then all we have left at that point is to look back and say, I should have taken more advantage of that opportunity. But it's too late. That's a time of regret, and that regret is not going to cause or give us anything. We hope that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with better understanding and acceptance of the teachings of the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt, to realize these are important things, that are a lot more important than other things that we deem important in our lives. And we hope that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, by the right of Imam al-Husayn, Imam Zain al-Abidin, the Imam of our time, who's born on the 15th of this month, that he helps us be involved in and practically get involved in these great worships, and inshallah be able to move towards ascending towards the divine, inshallah. Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Hali Hakimun Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Much of the Western mainstream media coverage of the ongoing crisis in Ukraine has displayed once again the blatant white supremacism that is still present in the Euro-American outlook onto the rest of the world. The article you're about to hear has been written by Denijal Jejic, a writer and researcher currently based in Beirut, Lebanon. He holds a PhD in American Studies. The article is titled Blatant Orientalism in Western Media Coverage of Ukraine War, and the article has been taken from Press TV's website. Much of the Western mainstream media's coverage of the ongoing crisis in Ukraine has displayed once again the blatant white supremacism that is still present in the Euro-American outlook onto the rest of the world. As many Ukrainians are forced to flee their homes as a result of the Russian intervention in Ukraine, the political and media discourse around refugees has at times been inherently racist. Numerous white Western journalists and media personalities could not hold back their outburst of Orientalism and white supremacy when reporting on the situation in Ukraine. The idea that a war could happen in civilized Europe surprised many pundits. Of course, Europe, which has caused both world wars, has waged its many colonial and imperialist wars mostly in the Third World. Besides the fact that war in Ukraine has been ongoing since 2014, and that an actual genocide took place in the 1990s in the cruel wars in Yugoslavia, the underlying assumption now was that because of Europe's alleged supremacy, the idea of war was only imaginable elsewhere in the uncivilized parts of the world. In fact, some of the current media coverage reproduces the Orientalist contrast between the civilized white Christian West and the uncivilized rest of the world. The British newspaper The Daily Telegraph published an article by Daniel Hanan, in which the author referred to Russia's actions as an attack on civilization itself. They, the author argued, referring to Ukrainians, seem so like us. That is what makes it so shocking. Stating that Ukraine is a European country, the author opposes its people who watch Netflix and have Instagram accounts to impoverished and remote populations. Reporting from Kiev, CBS News correspondent Charlie Degatta claims Ukraine is not a place with all due respect like Iraq or Afghanistan, but rather relatively civilized, relatively European. Speaking to the BBC, Ukraine's former deputy general prosecutor, David Sakvaridze, said, "It's very emotional for me because I see European people with blonde hair and blue eyes being killed every day with Putin's missiles and his helicopters and his rockets." His remarks remained unchallenged by the broadcaster, the BBC. These are but examples of the double standard and racist creation of difference. The rhetoric is based on the assumption that war is a natural circumstance outside of the allegedly superior European-American sphere, and that non-white people, that is the vast majority of the world's population, engage in wars because they are not civilized, not because of colonial and imperialist wars. This perspective also reveals how comfortably unaffected these media personalities must have been by all the wars launched against people in the Third World. White supremacy is the fundamental of European-American civilization. The Orientalist division of human beings into desirable and undesirable people has been structurally inscribed in dominant media discourse. The discourse around civilization not only reinforces Europe's violent racial hierarchies, but also explicitly normalizes warfare against people who do not look like the white, blue-eyed, blonde-haired European. The double standard has also been apparent in the compassionate support that some mainstream media outlets have extended to Ukrainians who took arms to fight against Russian troops. Sky News showed live on air how Ukrainians were manufacturing Molotov cocktails. The New York Post celebrated a Ukrainian soldier who blew himself up to prevent a Russian advance as heroic. Some Ukrainians have posted pictures online of themselves carrying weapons, like members of parliament Kyra Rudik. Their actions were widely praised. White victims are given moral and ideological support. Their militancy is glorified. Muslims and people of color who have organized in armed resistance are unlikely to be met with such praise. In fact, victims of U.S. imperialism and violence are themselves blamed, and their words and actions are policed. Palestinians who choose to resist the brutal decades-long Israeli occupation of their land are regularly condemned as militants and terrorists in the mainstream Western media. In fact, Palestinians do not even have to resist, as they're often by default depicted as a threat to Western civilization. Genocidal violence against them is presented as Israeli defense. The Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah, is not shown as patriotic heroes, but regularly demonized as an armed terrorist organization by the same media outlets that glorify white people taking up arms. The visible hypocrisy shows the staunch perseverance of white supremacism in mainstream Western media discourse. While the media creates powerful images and narratives, it also reflects societal dynamics. The double standard in reacting to war has been manifest in the continuous discrepancy between the rhetoric on freedom and democracy and a selective outrage. While the media creates powerful images and narratives, it also reflects societal dynamics. The double standard in reacting to war has been manifest in the continuous discrepancy between the rhetoric on freedom and democracy and the selective outrage. As Central and Eastern European governments have opened their borders for Ukrainian refugees, the racialization of people fleeing their homes continues. Poland allows white Ukrainians to cross the border, but there have been numerous reports of black people being denied entry to Poland, many of which remain stuck at the Ukrainian side of the border. This adds to the continuous mistreatment of refugees at the European Union and NATO's eastern frontier. The Bulgarian Prime Minister said that Ukrainian refugees were Europeans, educated and intelligent people, unlike previous refugees who might have been terrorists. The climate for the current discourse has been present for years. Long before Russia's intervention in Ukraine, anti-Russian fear-mongering has been part and parcel of Western narratives of the common enemy. The outspoken condemnation against Russia has swiftly entailed new sanctions and boycotts, with Russian media being banned and Russians being excluded from participating in sporting events. Meanwhile, calls for the boycott of the Israeli regime by Palestinians and human rights supporters around the world have vehemently been condemned by the European Union elites for years and oftentimes smeared as being anti-Semitic. The current dynamics reveal the unfortunate continuation of Orientalist and white supremacist structures. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat, or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to RIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered on February 17, 2022 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan, commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
In mid-1358, which equals to 1979, Tabriz faced a revolutionary attack. In Tabriz itself, there were a small number of vicious elements, but most of them poured to Tabriz from outside that city. They were also helped in some way from the center. Those disruptors were helped by some people. As a result, some individuals were worried. We were raising this issue at that time in the Revolutionary Council. Some individuals were really concerned. However, Imam said that the zealous people of Tabriz themselves would solve the problem and that no one needed to interfere. This was Imam's logic. In his speech, Imam also stated this. He said that Tabriz does not need the intervention of others, as Tabriz itself will calm the troubled waters. And that is exactly what it did. Shahid Madani, who was the Friday prayer leader of Tabriz at that time, replacing Shahid Ghazi, may God bestow paradise on him, was in the middle of the arena that day. Shahid Madani himself was in the middle of the ground, and the youth of Tabriz increasingly gathered behind him. Thousands of young people accompanied him and were able to overcome this conspiracy. Imam's move, outlook, and behavior brought about such a great success. That was a step. Such was the nature of Imam's work.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
One important example of Imam's acumen in helping the continuity of the revolution and the revolutionary move was the measures that he adopted during the sacred defense era. From the first day when Saddam's attack on some airports and areas began until the last day of the 8-year war and the adoption of the resolution, Imam would constantly encourage and breathe new life into the soldiers, the people, the supporters, and the officials of the country. In fact, Imam turned the war that was imposed on the Iranian nation into a tool to show the power of the nation. Well, we were really empty-handed inside the country. We were empty of weapons, of facilities, and of a regular and of a regular organization in the face of the enemy.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh,
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.